transparency, I'm not a big movie buff. So I'm often known for, there's a lot of jokes in my family and with friends about me falling asleep on movies. In fact, I've been known to fall asleep multiple times in the movie theater. In fact, they have those comfortable chairs. And don't get me one of those nice ones with the nice reclining chairs in a movie theater. I'm out. Like, yeah, I won't even make it through the first 5 minutes of a movie. It just happens like that. And it's not necessarily because the movie's bad or because it's boring. I just don't have a long attention span. I struggle to sit around and do nothing but stare at a screen for a long time. And then there's this odd thing that happens, and I've actually noticed this pattern. There's this odd thing that happens to me when I watch movies. I'll be fine for like almost to like the end of the movie. Like it'll be getting to like the good part where you can feel the movie wrapping up. And it's almost like my body knows the movie is getting ready to end. And it's like in the last 10 to 15 minutes, I'm just out like a light. Like I just like fall asleep. Like I'm sitting there, I'm trying to hold my eyes open. I'm like determined to make it through the movie because it's happened so many times, it's become predictable. But I typically fail. Unless I get, I found one thing works, unless I get up and start walking around in circles, which that annoys my wife. She hates it when I do that. But it's gotten so bad that the test of a good movie for me is whether or not I stay awake. And the movie we're talking about this morning is American Fiction, and it held my attention for an hour and 57 minutes. And so that lets you know what I think about this movie. It's well written. I think the acting is phenomenal. It's complex and challenging, but it's so good. And I felt like I needed to talk about this movie this morning. Now, I did go back a second time and watch it, knowing that I'd be discussing it in church. And I stayed awake that time too, but I also realized that I need to offer a language warning if you plan on watching this movie. There is some strong language and potentially offensive words in it, although the clips we're going to look at this morning are they're fairly PG. They're good. Now, American Fiction, if you haven't seen the movie or if you even haven't heard about it, it's a satire based on a 2001 novel called Erasure by Percival Everett. Now, I've not read the book, but I do think it's interesting that a book that was written that long ago, which feels funny to say 2001 was that long ago, but, you know, 3 years? That a book written in 2001 feels so relevant to where we are today. Now, it's difficult, I think, to produce good satire, because while the use of humor isn't the goal, sometimes humor in satire can almost become a distraction. But this film, the satire, the way it's used, the way humor is used in this film, doesn't distract us from the much richer cultural critique that exists in this movie. In fact, I think this movie uses humor in a very productive way to help us think more deeply and critically about the world we live in and how our actions shape it. Now, one of the reasons I like this movie is because I'm particularly interested in our tendency to reduce things to simplistic categories. We do this all the time with all kinds of things, most of the time without even realizing it, in an effort to make sense of our complex and nuanced world. And we tend to treat issues as if they're simply black and white and that they have easy answers and that the answers are kind of clear cut, which oftentimes they're not, but that just is our way of coping as we go through this kind of complex and sometimes crazy world we live in. So in many cases, these reductionistic tendencies are harmless. But oftentimes, I think our failure to think critically and make space for the possibility that there might be a different way, a better way, a more healing, more loving way to go through this world has unintended consequences. And that's really what we see in this film, in American Fiction. Now, the main characters in this movie are all black, and I think Court Jefferson, the writer and producer, does an excellent job of capturing the rich diversity in the black experience. And the storyline centers around a guy named Thelonious Monk, Thelonious Ellison, actually, but he goes by the name Monk. And it's not really relevant to the storyline, but he gets that nickname Monk from the 20th century jazz musician whose name is Thelonious Monk. And Monk is played by a guy named Jeffrey Wright, whose acting genius really shines in this movie. Man, his like nonverbals and his facial expressions throughout the movie are priceless. And like Monk is seeing, and you see this right from the very beginning of the movie, Monk is facing challenges in his career as a professor and as an author. In the academy, Monk's ideas and his, let's just say, teaching methods aren't being well received. And things aren't going much better in the publishing world either, as Monk's recent book is just struggling to find a publishing house that will pick it up or give it any attention. And then there's this scene early in the movie that just kind of sets the scene for what to expect in the movie, where Monk is having a conversation with his agent, and his agent tells him they want a black book, and Monk responds, "They have a black book. I'm black, and it's my book." And as the movie progresses, though, it becomes clear that the publishing world is placing higher value on books that present a monolithic version of the black experience. Books that reduce blackness to stereotypes that ignore the complexity and diversity that exists in the African-American community. And this movie, I think, does a good job of using satire to expose the media, particularly the publishing world's incessant tendency to reduce people of color to unhelpful stereotypes that all too often exploit a certain kind of narrative instead of exploring the rich diversity that exists within any demographic of people. And while this movie is pointing a finger at the publishing world, I think it's important for us to see that we're all actors in this capitalistic system, and that the publishing industry is oftentimes responding to market demand. And that's why our individual actions and the content we choose to consume matters. You see, not only does this reductionistic tendency make our society less democratic by failing to make space for diverse voices, but it devalues and diminishes the identity of those who don't fit the stereotype, whatever that stereotype might be, making it difficult for them to show up in this world fully as themselves and flourish in our society. And this leads to a kind of American fiction. Now, in the movie, Monk having this feeling of being misunderstood as an academic and as an author, he takes a leave of absence from work. We see this right in the kind of the opening scenes of the movie. He takes a leave of absence from work as a professor and travels back to Boston, where he grew up, hoping to clear his head. And while he's there, he goes to this book festival and he participates in this panel with other authors. But he's very disappointed because the attendance at least the panel that he's on is very low. Let's just say the turnout is low. And he begins to ask questions, and he finds out that there's another author that's holding a symposium at the same time, and her name is Centara Golden, who's played by Issa Rae, which you might have seen her in some other shows. She's a fantastic actress. And in this movie, Centara is kind of like Monk's nemesis. She writes the kind of books the publishing world values. And Monk feels like she's selling out and playing to the stereotype by writing books that reinforce this monolithic narrative. And we have this clip. I want you to see this first clip where Monk first encounters Centara Golden.
Anyway, have fun at the book festival. And just don't insult anyone important, please.
Writing from a historical perspective doesn't mean that you can't make work that doesn't resonate with today's audiences. I think of things like Game of Thrones as proof that nerds like us can still find great success.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you to our authors, and thanks to all of you for attending.
Is it just me, or was this small even for a book festival?
Yeah, it's because we're up against Centara.
Who?
Centaur Golden. You haven't read her?
No. What's her book called?
Raves Weeze Lives in the Ghetto is a heartbreaking and visceral debut. Plus, a little birdie told me that perhaps there's a TV adaptation in the works.
No comment.
Okay, it was worth the shot. Tell us, what was your life like before you were an author?
Well, I did undergrad at Oberlin and moved to New York the day after graduation. And a couple months later, I was an assistant at a publisher.
And did that assistant experience shape your writing?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was a first reader, meaning I would read all the manuscripts in the slush pile and send them up the ladder if they were any good. Some of them were great. Most were not. But the feeling I couldn't shake was that no matter how good the books were, most every submission was from some white dude from New York going through a divorce, and too few of them were about my people. And so I think, where are our stories? You know, where's our representation? And it was from that lack that my book was born.
Would you give us the pleasure of reading an excerpt?
Thank you. Yo, Sharonda, where you be going in a hurry like that? Donna asked me when she sees me coming out the house. Ain't none your business, but if and you gots to know, I was going to the pharmacy. I looks back at the door to see if mama coming out. The pharmacy? What for? She asks. You know, I says. Nah, she say. Hell nah. Girl, you be pregnant again? Mights be, I tells her. And if I is, Ray Ray is gonna be a real father this time around. Thank you.
That facial expression. But Monk can't help but notice the kind of interest and attention and even money these kind of books attract. And although his career is struggling and he could really use the money, Monk is unwilling to produce books that would contribute to the erasure of his experience as a black man in America. And ultimately, Monk just wants to be seen, known, valued for who he is, not for what the publishing world wants him to be, and not because he fits some stereotype. And this becomes evident in this next clip where Monk walks into a bookstore, and he's frustrated because when he goes into the store, he sees his book in the African American Studies section of the store. Let's see what happens here.
Excuse me, Ned. Do you have any books by the writer Thelonious Ellison?
Yeah, this way. Here you go.
Right. Yeah. Wait a minute. Why are these books here?
I'm not sure. I would imagine that this author, Ellison, is black.
That's me. Ellison.
Yeah.
He is me. And he and I are black.
Oh, bingo.
No bingo, Ned. These books have nothing to do with African-American studies. They're just literature. The blackest thing about this one is the ink.
I don't decide what sections the books go in, and no one here does. That's how chain stores work.
Right. Ned, you don't make the rules.
I'm just gonna put them back after you leave.
Don't you dare, Ned. Do not you dare.
Oh, man. There's so many clips like that in this movie. This raises a much broader conversation about the role of stereotypes. Now, stereotyping actually evolved as a cognitive tool that made it possible for humans to efficiently make sense of the world around them by categorizing elements in the environment. Stereotyping enabled quick decision-making and adaptation to unfamiliar situations. In fact, our early human ancestors and early human societies used stereotypes which served a very practical, and some might even say essential, purpose for them by producing decision-making shortcuts that were based on observable characteristics and behaviors. For instance, by categorizing an animal as a predator or prey, right, you didn't have to test it out and find whether your assumptions were correct. You could stereotype based on the appearance of the animal and quickly identify and assess potential threats. However, over time, as we see in this movie, the use of stereotypes has evolved into rigid, often oversimplified, reductionistic beliefs about people based on observable traits like race. And as a result, rather than creating space for diversity within a category, within a demographic, stereotypes often today create boundaries and barriers that exclude people. They limit opportunities, and they often perpetuate narratives that lead to prejudice and implicit bias. And when used this way, stereotypes often make it difficult for us to truly see people, to know them, and to appreciate individuals for who they are. And in American fiction, Monk is pushing back against this. He is rejecting the publishing world's attempt to place him in some predetermined category based on the color of his skin. Instead, he wants the work that he puts out into the world to be seen, to be appreciated, to be valued for what it is, not for its place within some larger racial category, and not because it aligns with a narrative expected from him as an African-American author. And as the movie unfolds, we begin to see why the publishing industry's bias, which, remember, is largely driven by market demand, is so insidious. You see, Monk is more than just an academic and an author. He has a life and real-world responsibilities outside of work. In fact, the movie develops a whole nother storyline that we don't really have time to get in this morning, but through this storyline, we learn that Monk's father died by suicide several years ago. His gay brother is estranged from the family. We meet his sister. She's a surgeon, a very successful surgeon, who's been caring for Monk's aging mother. But then Monk's sister dies of a heart attack early in the movie, and suddenly, the financial responsibility of caring for his mother rests solely on Monk, and he desperately needs money. And then one day, while sitting in the waiting room at his mother's medical appointment, Monk opens a magazine only to see his nemesis, another article praising Centaur Golden's novel. And he's extremely frustrated. He goes home, he sits down at his computer, and he begins typing out this novel under a pseudonym. And the pseudonym was Stag Lee. So under the name Stag Lee, he begins typing out this novel, and it's the stereotypical black story the publishing world seems to value. Like, it's got broken families, police brutality, drug addiction, gang shootouts. I mean, it's pretty crazy. I couldn't show that scene because it gets pretty wild. Be warned. And he's not really taking it seriously. He's just pounding this story out on the keyboard in frustration, and he sends it to his publisher as a joke, thinking there's no way, or to his agent as a joke, thinking there's no way a publisher will pick up this novel. But as you might expect, while Monk's serious novel is struggling to get interest from a publisher in a large publishing house, one quickly jumps on his stereotypical joke novel. Check out this clip where Monk finds out that a publisher wants to purchase his novel.
Paula Bateman from Thompson Watt.
She always passes.
Not this time. They want to preempt $750,000.
No one's ever offered that much to me.
This is you.
No, it's not, Arthur.
You wrote it.
As a joke.
Well, now it's the most lucrative joke you've ever told.
And I'm not selling.
Why not?
Because it's trash, Arthur. You didn't even want to send it out the other day.
But look who's suddenly overcome his fears. I know. I broke the first rule of sales. Never underestimate how stupid everyone is.
Well, I'm not participating in making them any stupider.
Well, you haven't thus far, which is admirable, but you also haven't made any money. Does your mom need help these days? Check this out.
I don't care how drunk we get, I'm not selling it.
That's not what I'm doing. Johnny Walker Red, $24. Johnny Walker Black, $50. Johnny Walker Blue, $160. You see the metaphor?
No.
These are all made by the same company. The red is black is less blue is good. But fewer people buy the blue because it's expensive. And at the end of the day, most people just want to get drunk. Most of your career, your books have been blue. They're good, complex, but they're not popular because most people want something easy. Now, for the first time ever, you've written a red book. It's simple, prurient. It's not great literature, but satisfies an urge. And that's valuable. What I'm trying to illustrate is that just because you do red doesn't mean you can't also do blue. You can do it all. Like Johnny Walker. In fact, you got Johnny Walker beat because you don't even have to put your real name on it.
Jesus. Do we drink now?
Hello?
Hello, Paula.
Arthur, so wonderful to hear from you. I hope that you are with the man of the hour.
I am indeed. He's right here next to me.
Mr. Lee?
Yeah, this is he.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, I was a little confused at first, but...
We're both very excited to discuss Thompson Watt's offer.
Yes, well, first of all, let me just say that all of us here at Thompson Watt are thrilled with My Pathology. It is about as perfect a book as I have seen in a long, long while.
Just raw and real.
And Mr. Lee, is this based on your actual life?
Yeah, you think some college boy can come up with that
No, I don't. No. You know, that kind of visceral energy cannot be taught, right? Stag. May I call you? Now, is Stag a pseudonym?
Yes, it is. Mr. Lee can't use his real name because he's a wanted fugitive.
Oh, my God. Wow.
That's why this couldn't be a video conference.
Are you crazy? What if they fact-check this? I check. There's barely money to pay editors anymore. Just go with it.
Yeah, I did a 12-year bid, but no going back. Know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've been reading a lot about the prison abolition movement.
Oh, God.
Sorry to rush, Paula, but can we talk business? Mr. Lee values his time outside of a cell.
Of course, I'm sure you're both very, very busy, so I will get right to it. You'll notice that our offer is unusually large, and that is because we believe Mr. Lee has written a bestseller. We think it is going to be the read of the summer.
Yeah, I'm sure white people on the Hamptons will delight in it.
Yeah, we will. It's going to be huge, huge. I love it.
All right. So life and situations, and Monk needs the money, and he gives in to the pressure and publishes the kind of book the publishing world values, even though it perpetuates the stereotype he despises. And this deepens his feeling of being unseen, unheard, unknown, and unvalued in the world. And this brings me to one of my favorite chapters in the Hebrew scriptures, Psalm 139. You might be familiar with it. The whole chapter is a prayer to God, and it's very meditational in quality. The opening verses invite us to consider the vastness of God's knowledge and to delight in the idea that we are fully known by God, which wouldn't be such a positive thing if we weren't also so fully loved by God. You know, and the psalmist knows that God's love knows no limits, no boundaries, it has no obstacles. And the author of this psalm seems astonished by the depth of God's knowledge. Look at what it says. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, Lord, you know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Now notice in this chapter the repeated use of the pronoun you, emphasizing God's active role in pursuing knowledge about us. The author says, you search me, you know me, you perceive, you discern, you are familiar, you know, you hem me in or surround me, you lay your hand upon me. You see, in Psalm 139, God is actively involved in getting to know us. And this, I don't know about you, but this is contrary to the way I have typically thought about God's knowledge. There's a theological word that's often used to describe God, which is omniscient. And it literally means to possess knowledge of all things, which I've often thought of as a static state, an attribute of God. God knows everything, not because God learned it, but because God is God, and God just has it like that. And to be honest, I never thought too deeply about it because the idea of possessing full and complete knowledge is a concept that I really can't wrap my mind around. It actually makes my brain hurt just to think about it. There's some other theological concepts that do the same thing, like the idea of eternity is one of those. When I was growing up in my church, we would always talk about eternity being a prize from God, and people would say things like, we'll spend eternity sitting around the throne of God, worshiping God. And that didn't sound like a prize to me. It was one of those concepts I couldn't wrap my mind around. I just told you, I can't sit through a movie, so the idea of sitting for eternity worshiping God sounded like torture. And I think this is what the author of this psalm is trying to express in a much more eloquent way than I am, is that the vastness of God's knowledge is a concept he just can't wrap his mind around. It makes his brain hurt, man. He doesn't say that. Look at what he says in verse 6. He says, such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. You see, the author of this psalm is writing about a God who, or isn't writing about a God who simply has full and complete knowledge as a static attribute, but a God who's taken an interest in us, a God who sought to understand us. Look again what he says in Psalm 139, verse 1. You searched me, Lord, and you know me. You searched me, Lord, and you know me. The author of this psalm seems to be grasping for language to express that God's comprehensive knowledge is not simply something God possesses, but something God pursues. God doesn't need cognitive tools to efficiently make sense of the world. God doesn't have to reduce us to categories or stereotypes. Rather, God sees us fully as individuals, and God knows us completely and values us and loves us for who we are. And I believe God sets the example for how we are to live and navigate in this world. This means we must live with a certain kind of intentionality, paying attention to the content we consume and how it shapes and forms how we see the world. We got to resist the tendency to reduce people to categories that predetermine their identity. Instead, we must actively seek to know people in all their wonderful complexity. You know, it's much simpler, it's easier to categorize people But the way of Jesus in this world calls us to love people, which means seeing them, seeking to know them, valuing them, making space for their identity and their unique perspective to be heard, which is becoming increasingly difficult in the world we live in. Not being quick to judge is right or wrong, but doing as the scripture says, that says, be quick to listen. Being eager to learn and open to a diversity of perspectives. Now, throughout this movie, American Fiction, I found myself taking a side, having a perspective, sometimes a really strong perspective. I felt like Centauri was an antagonist. At times, I was just as frustrated as Monk with the kind of work she was putting out into the world. I felt like her books fed the stereotype and that her writing was unhelpful, especially considering the fact that it didn't represent her own experience, as you saw in that first clip where she talks about her education and what her life was like. But then came this scene where she speaks about her perspective. And while I do not necessarily agree with her, she does make some strong points. Now, in this clip, we're going to see Monk and Centauri discussing the book that Monk wrote under the pseudonym. And Centauri doesn't know that Monk wrote it yet, but she's expressed frustrations with it, similar to the frustrations that Monk has with her books. And Monk is struggling to understand why she doesn't like his book, because from his perspective, it's just like the books she writes. And in this clip we're getting ready to watch, you'll notice that the name of the book that Monk writes is muted, because at a point in the movie, in a way to kind of push the publishing world's buttons and see how far they're willing to go, he renames his book to a four-letter word. And as you might imagine, the publishers loved it and went with it. So that word's not going to be in this clip. So let's just watch this clip and see.
Do you mind if I ask you something?
Sure.
What about, did you find pandering?
Oh, I can't really put my finger on it, but it's not different from some of what's out there, but it just felt soulless is the word that I'm gonna use. You said you agreed, right?
Yeah, I do. I think it seems written to satisfy the tastes of guilt-ridden white people.
Yeah, the kind of book critics call important and necessary, but not well-written.
Exactly. Okay, so, please don't take offense at this, but how is so very different from your book?
Is that what this is about? You think my book's trash?
No, to be honest, I haven't read your book. I've read excerpts, and it didn't seem so dissimilar.
I did a lot of research for my book. Some of it was actually taken from real interviews. Maybe you've been up in your ivory tower of academia for so long you've forgotten that some people's lives are hard.
Your life? You went to an exclusive bohemian college, you had a job at a fancy publishing house in New York.
So what? I don't need to write about my life. I write about what interests people.
You write what interests white publishers fiending black trauma porn.
They're the one buying the manuscripts. Is it bad to cater to their tastes?
If you're okay feeding people's base desires for profit.
I'm okay with giving the market what it wants.
That's how drug dealers excuse themselves.
And I think drugs should be legal.
But you're not fed up with it. Black people in poverty, black people rapping, black people as slaves, black people murdered by the police, whole soaring narratives about black folks in dire circumstances who still manage to maintain their dignity before they die. I mean, I'm not saying these things aren't real, but we're also more than this. And it's like so many writers like you can't envision us without some white boot on our necks.
Do you get angry at Bret Easton Ellis or Charles Bukowski for writing about the downtrodden? Or is your ire strictly reserved for black women?
Yeah, you know, nobody reads Bukowski thinking his is the definitive white experience, but people, white people, read your book and confine us to it. They think that we're all like that.
Then it sounds like your issue is with white people, Monk, not me.
Maybe, but I also think that I see the unrealized potential of black people in this country.
Potential is what people see when they think what's in front of them isn't good enough.
So, what are we talking about?
Oh man, that line, potential is what people see when they think what's in front of them isn't good enough, is powerful. You know, sometimes we just have to sit with clips like that. It's such a complex and complicated conversation. Tara makes some strong points. Just putting my cards on the table, I'm still not on her side. But I must admit that this conversation made my perspective a little more nuanced, a little less black and white. And that's what I think I like about this movie. Is that it won't let you just sit and watch it passively. It'll force you to think, to ask questions that are uncomfortable. And I believe that's a good thing. I believe that's a necessary thing. And I think the world would be a lot better if we're willing to sit with those uncomfortable questions. All right, we'll end there. The band can come back up as we prepare for communion. I want to read a little bit more of Psalm 139. In verses 7 through 12, we read verse 1 through 6, but in 7 through 12, the emphasis shifts from God's activity to ours. And the author of the psalm is emphasizing that there's nothing that we can do to escape God's presence. Listen to Psalm 139, verse 7 through 12. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely darkness will hide me and light will become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. And what we see here is that there's no action or activity that'll make us unseen, unknown by God. And maybe that freaks you out a little bit because we're used to being able to hide, escape, to mask, to cover up. And we do that out of fear oftentimes because we don't know if we're going to be accepted, if we're going to be loved, if we're going to be embraced. But in this psalm, we see that we can be who we fully are and that nothing we can do can escape God's glance, that God sees us. And what the author of this psalm understands is that God sees us, God knows us, God values us, God loves us, and is able to lead us in the way of life. And that's why he writes at the end of this chapter, and it's not on the screens. I'm going to read it, these last two verses of this chapter, 23 and 24. I'll read it twice and just let it, I don't know, sink in or think about it a little bit as we share in communion. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you and lead me along the path of everlasting life. Search me, O God, know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you and lead me along the path of everlasting life. Well, this morning, like every morning, there's communion that's prepared at these two tables up front, and there's one in the center. It's an opportunity to sit and reflect and think about what it means to follow Jesus and the kind of sacrifice that love requires of us. There's other ways that you might want to respond. Those are on the community flyer that you got when you came in. And this is really just a moment for us to sit and reflect. You don't even have to do anything in this moment if you don't want to. But let's just spend some time reflecting and pondering and doing as this psalm says, asking God to point out anything in me that offends you and lead me in the path of everlasting.